The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Well, calling you from a crisis-driven Washington, D.C., where we're trying to reconcile whether or not the government will still be operating in 48 hours. We've got sort of a potpourri show for you today. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about election issues. First of all, how social media impacts them, and then talking about campaign finance changes. We're also going to look at the issue of micro-philanthropy and how donors can get more involved with the projects they support. But we're going to start things off by talking a little bit about the Secretary of Transportation's recent plans in the area of pipeline safety, one of those classic Capital Thinking issues that doesn't get the attention it deserves, but that's very important in your everyday life. Joining us for that discussion, Gordon Arbuckle, a longtime partner at the law firm of Patton Boggs, a colleague of mine there, somebody who has a great deal of experience in working on pipeline issues over the last few decades, represented major pipelines, defended major pipeline prosecutions. So, Gordon, welcome back to the show, and let's start off with Secretary LaHood. He was in Allentown Monday, discussing a new DOT initiative on pipeline safety. And there seems to be a lot of rhetoric and outreach events, but it's not really clear where the Secretary and where the Obama administration is taking this critical issue. So fill us in a little bit.
Hi, Kevin, and hi, everybody. Well, this is about regulation of the interstate pipeline system, and we're concentrating on gas pipelines today because that's the area of greatest attention in LaHood's announcement on Monday. Like every major enforcement initiative in the history of pipeline regulation, this is a response to incidents. Last September, there was a pipeline explosion in San Bruno, California, killed 8 people, blew up 36 homes. In February, there was a similar incident in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which incidentally was the location of Mr. LaHood's speech, killed 5 people, sort of blew up the central business district.
So no coincidence he was giving his remarks there?
Absolutely not. And both of those incidents involved distribution pipelines. Historically, the DOT regulation has concentrated on your major interstate transmission pipelines, but in 2006, the Congress passed something called the Pipes Act that required DOT to look at the distribution systems, which is the utility that actually delivers gas to your house. And now it is about, it's 2011 now, 5 years later, the first set of DOT regulations regulating distribution systems and requiring them to regulate the integrity of the pipelines becomes effective in August. So you had an accident in September, you had an incident in February. The National Transportation Safety Board issued a letter to PHMSA, which is DOT's agency, which regulates pipelines. It's called the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Issued an urgent letter saying, you know, you need to get out there and respond to this risk of distribution pipelines, which are now being regulated for the first time. And so that's what LaHood was doing. Secretary LaHood was doing. He's showing the flag and showing that the Department of Transportation is on the job and is doing something to prevent these kind of horrible accidents.
So, Gordon, you talk a lot about accidents, and we've just been through, you know, in the recent sort of public policy pass, this whole Macondo experience. Is pipeline regulation, anything like deep water drilling regulation, is there some parallel there?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarity. Both the operation of pipelines and the drilling of deep wells under the water are highly technical subject matters. Probably pipelines are not quite as highly technical, but they're still highly technical. And the industry is pretty far ahead of the regulators when it comes to understanding exactly what the best practices are, what the safety standards should be, and so forth. So there is a sort of a necessary relationship or partnership between industry and the regulators. A lot of meetings that are held together, lots of discussion, and it creates at least an appearance of coziness. And as we saw in after Macondo, that type of appearance creates finger-pointing, creates public resentment after the fact, and you get some fairly significant enforcement responses or liability responses. And add to that the fact that in the pipeline incidents, they're horrible accidents. You have families burned while they're having a picnic beside the river. You have young men burned up while they're fishing, and it governs a significant adverse public reaction and very, very substantial enforcement responses.
Excellent. Well, that's a great synopsis. So, the LaHood initiative that was announced Monday. What do you see as the consequences of that initiative? If you're a pipeline company, or if you're just somebody worried about safety in general.
Well, keep in mind that this is the first time that the sort of utilities that operate the distribution pipelines have been subject to a regulatory regime regarding their risk management and integrity management practices. So they are new to the game, okay? And what LaHood's initiative does is it basically calls the industry out, the transmission industry, the gas transmission industry, that are pretty far ahead of the utilities when it comes to best practices, standards, et cetera, and calls upon them to enunciate what they are doing. So what this is going to do is it is pretty aggressively going to raise the standard of care, which is applicable to the utilities. And the utilities are going to have to accommodate to these high standards in a very, prompt way and a very insightful and effective way. If they do not do that, and there does happen to be an accident like there was in California, the utility is going to find itself scrambling to show that it wasn't grossly negligent, to show that it wasn't criminally negligent, and to show that its fines and penalties should not be through the roof. And keep in mind that this is not necessarily a situation where you're only dealing with a regulatory agency, because where there are these kinds of high-profile public accidents. You see the Justice Department involved. You see both civil and criminal prosecutions, and people have gone to jail, and people have spent time in halfway houses, as well as fines in the tens of millions of dollars and corrective action requirements in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So this is a big, big risk that the utilities need to accommodate to on a short and effective basis.
Why don't you walk me through, if you were advising a company that is in this business or has some of this risk, what are some of the key things they need to focus on?
Well, there are two basic things that the companies need to do, okay? They need to have in place, and more importantly, document that they have in place an effective risk and integrity management program that meets or exceeds the standards that DOT sets in its regulations that are becoming effective in August, and also that get enunciated in this process of collaboration that Secretary LaHood is calling for. And that's a pretty extensive engagement. You have to mark your pipelines. You have to periodically assess their integrity, either by a close interval survey or by internal investigation devices. And you have to demonstrate that you actively and appropriately interpret the information from these surveys. I mean, sometimes in the past on the transmission lines, you have an anomaly discovered in a survey. It's not immediately corrected. It accrues fines at the rate of $10,000 or $25,000 a day, and Mr. LaHood wants to increase that. And over 10 years, $10,000 a day adds up to a fair amount of money. And plus that, if there's an accident, you have the kinds of consequences that I've discussed, okay? So those programs in place and documentation of those programs in place will help avoid the accident. So that's step one, have in place those programs. And the second thing that you need to do is you need to be ready to respond if an incident does occur. That means, number one, you need to know the notification requirements and be ready to comply with them, because failure to give notice is the biggest source of criminal liability in these kinds of situations. And you need to know who you're going to call to help you respond to the event. And that means you need a 24-hour number so you can call your technical advisor to come take possession of the pipe, and take pictures of the site, be in a position to expertly analyze and comment on the cause of the accident. You probably want to have the counsel that you're going to use to defend yourself in any litigation that ensues on call and ready to go at the same time, and your total response team having walked through the deal and known exactly what they should do.
Gordon, I'm going to have to cut you off there only because we got to go to commercial. I think that's fantastic advice. If folks want more information, they can email Gordon at garbuckle, GARBUCKLE, at pattenboggs.com. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about social media and election 2012.
Thank you all.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. We're going to talk a little bit about elections for the next half hour in a little bit, two different contexts. Our first guest, Matt DeVries, is a former political junkie who spent some time on Capitol Hill working for Pete Domenici, a former senator from the great state of New Mexico in the early 90s. And then he reformed and left Washington, where he's been a successful, moved out to Tennessee. He's been a successful construction and employment lawyer and is also the author of BestPracticesConstructionLaw.com, a cutting-edge construction blog that focuses on green building, transportation, and technology issues as they relate to the law. So we had Matt on before a little earlier this spring to talk about social media in general. And, Matt, you almost got me to be a regular Twitterer. Not yet, but you're getting there. So let's start back from the beginning and talk a little bit more about just social media in general and the legal world, then we'll get into some nitty-gritty here.
Well, Kevin, thanks for having me back on, and I'm glad to see you at least tweeting a couple more times. And in my own world, I look at all the platforms out there, and I've had to delve into new areas myself. So when we talk about social media, as we covered last time in February, you know, cutting to the basics, we're talking about the social media platforms. It's what people know as Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, blogging. Those are all platforms where people are making connections, whether it's in a personal level, whether it's a professional development level, whether it's a news organization creating new platforms that tie in with their current website and how they get data out there. Those are all platforms that we talk about. So let's take some personal examples. You know, just in Facebook, I may create a Facebook account that gets me connected with old friends from high school and college, and so that's a specific platform. I may create a Twitter account, which is like kind of mini blogging or texting, and I have a certain people who follow me in the construction industry or in the employment industry, and I may send on useful content to them. I, of course, you mentioned the blog that I have. Another major platform would be YouTube. You know, how organizations and individuals are making, whether they're public announcements, whether they're commercials or informative educational videos, whatever it is, they're using these new platforms to get information out there. So it's all across all walks of life, personal, business development, sports. You have sports players who are, you know, announcing which team they're going to jump on.
Yeah,
and they tweet about it, and it gets out there before the mainstream media gets out there. So those are all examples of the social media platforms we're talking about.
Let's talk about some of the missteps and the things that have gone wrong with social media since we had you on earlier this spring. What do you see as some of the big faux pas that have gone down this year?
Well, there's the three major ones probably some of your audience members have heard about. Of course, there was the Aflac incident. If you know Gilbert Godfrey, a comedian, and
yeah,
he often gets out there and is on the cutting edge of walking the line of what's appropriate and not, and following the tsunami incidents in Japan, he made some rather inappropriate jokes on his Twitter account, and Aflac did not agree as far as their professional standards, and fired him as the voice of the Aflac duck. So that's one of those areas where, you know, just one or two bad tweets can affect a contractual relationship. Another example in the media is Red Cross. They had a social media employee who was running Red Cross's Twitter account, and that individual meant to send it out through their own personal account, and things got cross-referenced, and there was a post about accidentally getting slizzard, which they talked about finding some beer and getting drunk, and Red Cross, of course, had a good PR person involved and turned that incident around and made an apology for the post, but also said, you know, Red Cross is not getting slizzard, we're getting donations, and made a play on words. So that was one that turned around really well, and I guess the most the hottest one reported in the media was with Chrysler, and Chrysler had a company called New Media Strategies that was doing their social media campaigns, and the individual who was running that dropped the F-bomb over Twitter in a post. He said, "I find it ironic that Detroit is known as the Motor City, and yet no one here knows how to blank drive." And he actually dropped the F-bomb, and Chrysler immediately turned around and fired that ad agency, and you know, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenues for that company. So those are some of the missteps you see out there. So it's just a cautionary tip to be careful what you're getting into, and that's how I advise employers, whether it's in the construction industry or other employers who are stepping out in the social media world.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about politics. I saw a recent piece in Politico about Obama sort of facing this new brave web world, and, you know, he actually launched his campaign on the web this week. He didn't go on the Today Show or do anything else. So tell me, what do you think Obama and whoever his Republican opponent will be, how will social media change the political campaign the next couple years?
Well, I think we see the difference in a couple areas. You know, one of the areas first is what was innovative in 2008. You know, candidate Obama was using his website and a very tight, tailored, targeted email list to raise millions of dollars and reach thousands of people. And back then, he had a strong group of savvy technology guys working on the background, and they really put their arms around what the campaign was going to do. And what's innovative in 2012 and the upcoming elections is you literally have hundreds of various social media platforms. I just named three or four at the very beginning, was Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, but there are hundreds and hundreds of plugins, various software applications that plug into major media sites, and an individual can have a following of a couple thousand people, and what that one individual may influence politically a particular issue or towards a particular candidate. So when we look at what's innovative out there, we're in a different political climate just by the technology. But as far as Obama's concerned, we're also talking about controlling the message. You know, we all understand, you know, I went to American University, studied political science, and went through the Campaign Management Institute and a 3-week course, and really everything they taught us as campaigners was who controls the message and what is that message. So in 2008, Obama's website was the main hub, and his team aggressively monitored and took over unofficial websites out there. And so everything that was out there, whether it was an outpost media, it would point back to the main website. Well, in 2012, we're going to have a focus shift on who's controlling those outposts, I guess we call them. He's going to need to figure out how to play in these new social media playgrounds. Let me give you an example. In a political campaign, you may have your home base. That's the area that the campaign owns and controls. That's going to be your website. You're going to have your embassies, and that's the area that the campaign doesn't own, but you have a registered profile. For example, Twitter, Facebook. So
right.
They don't own the Twitter or Facebook domain where it's located, but they have a registered profile there, and they can control part of the message. Now, in the new arena of political campaigning on the Internet, we now have major outposts, and that is the area that the campaign doesn't own or doesn't control. Those are going to be your blogs. Those are going to be your Facebook pages, your LinkedIn groups of people who get together, organize, and now are controlling the message. And really, it's a matter of how can a candidate, whether it's Obama or someone else, really go out there and control that. So, you know, I read the political article as well, and you know, Facebook was once funneled to the Obama campaign, and even Obama's campaign blogger stated in that article, everyone's on Facebook now. So, you know, they're just going to have to go to a different territory, and I think that's really what the lesson is for political campaigning in the next coming cycle.
Well, so what do we talk from what we talked about today? What would you give as sort of the big piece of advice or takeaway?
Well, I think a couple things. We need to understand that everything we do is about relationships, and I'm talking about whether we're in work, in our play, education, and as we're talking today, in politics and governing. So it's about the candidate making a connection or a relationship to a potential voter or supporter, whether it's for their vote or for financial support. So everything we do is about relationships. And what we need to understand is the environment is rapidly changing. And so, you know, I'm a construction lawyer, so I want to make connections with potential clients. I'm also a father of six. I need to make sure that I'm connecting with my kids. I'm meeting them at their level. And from the political realm, we need to understand that candidates are in a new playground. The technology is rapidly changing, and so they're going to have to get their message out there through new channels. They're going to have to understand the risks. Like we talked about these social media missteps earlier, those risks are going to be real for campaigns as well. So they're going to have a plan and policy in place to react to those missteps and really understand how they're going to control the message out there.
Gotcha. Well, I think that's going to have to do it for us, Matt. I always enjoy talking social media with you, and I think it's going to be fascinating to track the election issues as they stand in regards to social media, so I'm sure we'll have you back sometime soon. We're going to be back in a minute to talk more about election law with our campaign finance expert. Just a moment.
Thanks. Take care.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth?
The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patent Vogs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Vogs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Vogs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, time for one of my favorite guests here on Capital Thinking, my good friend Bill McGinley, election law partner at Patton Boggs, a guy who has a great deal of experience in that area, having been general counsel to the National Republican Senatorial Committee during one recent election cycle, and also having served as deputy counsel to the Republican National Committee. And we're going to talk with Bill a little bit about what's going on in the election finance world. And Bill, let's start with what's happening in the Supreme Court, because you have some update on some new case law there that's relevant to the election world.
Yeah. This, first of all, it's good to be with you, Kevin. The Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments in a case where parties were challenging Arizona's public financing regime for its state and local candidates. And they brought a First Amendment challenge because the law allows candidates who opt in to take taxpayer funding would receive increased funding from the taxpayers if they were attacked by independent expenditure groups, or if their opponent elected not to take the public financing and actually had amassed more money through private donations. And so the challengers brought a challenge in federal court that reached the Supreme Court. And the issue there is whether, you know, a law that's designed to level the playing field by giving, you know, the public financed candidate a greater voice in the process to bring them up to parity violates the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most reports from the oral argument have come back saying that the five-justice majority that produced the Citizens United decision seem to be pretty skeptical of the law and believe that it's probably going to fall when they render the decision.
Gotcha. Very, always interesting when the Supreme Court starts to look at this stuff, isn't it, Bill?
And what's also interesting is, you know, on the federal level, we still have on the books the taxpayer funding of presidential elections, both at the primary stage and at the general election phase, for candidates who decide to opt into that. So a lot of people will be looking at whatever decision is handed down from the Supreme Court in this case to see if it produces any new issues that may exist in the federal public financing regime at the presidential level, or whether it reinforces the constitutionality of that regime, such as when the Supreme Court originally reviewed it in the Buckley case.
Well, let's shift gears from the Supreme Court over to the FEC. I'd seen some news reports this week that President Obama's got some interesting challenges over at the FEC. Tell us a little bit about what's happening there.
Well, the campaign finance reform community is not happy with the current makeup of the commission. The commission is made up of six members. No more than three can be from one party. And the current makeup right now is three Republicans, two Democrats, and one independent. The independent is somebody who was chosen by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and so caucuses basically and is considered a Democrat. But five of these commissioners, their terms have expired. These commissioners serve for a six-year term, and five of them are holdovers, and so they are eligible for replacement. Commissioners cannot serve two consecutive terms. And so the reform community, because they're not happy with some of the decisions that are coming out of the FEC, including a lot of decisions that deadlock on a 3-3 basis, are calling on the president to replace these commissioners with a new crop of commissioners to try and change the actions of the commission. And so it presents an interesting dilemma for the president, just because, you know, he has kind of staked out this reformer posture on these types of issues, but there's really, you know, because of the politics in the Congress and elsewhere, it's really doubtful whether there's going to be any action on that front.
Yeah, I mean, isn't this sort of the interesting situation where you kind of get to appoint the people who will referee your own reelection fight?
That's
right. If you could actually get it through. I mean, that would seem to me that Republicans wouldn't want to deal with that. And you know, I think one of the articles I read basically said Harry Reid's got his guy there, Mitch McConnell, his minority leader, has his guy there, Obama has his guy there, and none of them are willing to see their guy go for somebody else's guy to come on.
That's right. And I think, you know, as much as the campaign finance reformers believe that campaign finance issues are very important to the general public, I think when compared to the budget and the other issues faced by the nation, I don't think anybody really expects either President Obama or anybody else to waste any political capital on appointing commissioners to the Federal Election Commission.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting dynamic to watch, simply because what we're talking about is, you know, the upcoming presidential election. And, you know, after the Citizens United decision, you know, we saw so much money come in to the midterm elections, and there was kind of this misperception that it was heavily stacked in favor of the Republican or conservative side. You see the Democrats and the liberals actually being much more upfront about what they intend to do on the outside front, including recent news reports that two former White House staffers who left a number of months ago are thinking about forming an outside group that will essentially be supportive of the president's reelections effort.
So let's talk about the reelection. Our last guest was talking a little bit about social media. Tell me how you think social media and technology really interplays with election campaign finance law and causes some difficulties for candidates going forward.
See, I think social media, while it may cause difficulties for candidates in that it diminishes their ability to really control the message, what people are hearing, I think it's actually good for democracy. As the Supreme Court noted in the Citizens United decision, you know, technology has really lowered the barriers for people to participate in the political process. You know, you can have a well-financed campaign with millions of dollars in the war chest produce YouTube videos to try and get their message out. But it could be the guy sitting or gal sitting in the basement who produces a video about an issue that they are very passionate about that could go viral. And we saw that a couple of times in the 2008 presidential election, where there were a number of YouTube videos, and one of them wasn't produced in a basement. It was produced at a media firm by a young staffer. I think we all remember the Hillary 1984 takeoff video that saw millions and had millions and millions of views on YouTube.
Yeah.
And you can see similar stuff will probably emerge at some point during this election cycle. And so social media does a couple of things. It gives campaigns multiple outlets to reach their supporters, to engage and activate them. But what it also does is their detractors and their supporters will also have those tools available to them on an individual basis to try and shape the debate in the way that they want it to be shaped. And so I think this is going to be a much more cluttered message universe in 2012 than we saw in 2008, because as your previous guest noted, candidate websites by and large are platforms where the campaign pushes the message out that they want the public to receive. Social media, by its very nature, is something where there is a give and take. And so the message is you just lose the ability to control the message in the same way that you do when you don't have those types of participatory platforms like you see with Twitter, YouTube, or Facebook.
Well, so, Bill, you and I, we were chatting a couple weeks ago about election 2012 stuff, and you were adamant that this was going to be the month that we were going to see all the presidential campaigns sort of kick it into high gear. Tell me a little bit about your theory and why you think that is.
Well, I'm not so sure that's going to be the case anymore. As in politics, a week is a lifetime, a month is an eternity. And, we saw the president jump in
Monday.
Last week. Or on Monday.
Not last week, Monday, man.
Yeah,
only
Monday at the beginning of the month. Former Governor Tim Pawlenty jumped in last month with an exploratory committee. He didn't formally declare his candidacy. But I think that everybody else who is kind of weighing their options about whether to get in are looking at kind of the news cycle and a number of different factors, and it may be more like May or June before we see a lot of people get in, and possibly July.
Really? So they would go the whole second quarter and miss out on the fundraising?
What's that?
They'd miss out on a whole second quarter of fundraising?
They certainly would, but, in some respects, what they're looking at is, I think they're trying to count back from the Iowa straw poll, if that's something they're going to participate in. Politico and NBC moved their presidential debate, which was supposed to be the first one in May, they moved it back all the way to September. And so it looks like on the Republican side, things are just going to be delayed a bit longer before we get into the full campaign season. But I think once it begins, I think it's just going to be nonstop. It's going to be more of a sprint up until the first in the nation caucuses in Iowa. And then we'll probably see more of a protracted nomination process on the Republican side.
So I got to ask you a funny question. I was watching the Today Show this morning, Donald Trump on, talking about why he couldn't declare for president yet because he has the number one rated show in The Celebrity Apprentice. Then later, Bill Cosby's on the show and says, oh, he could declare. What do you make of Trump, and does that TV show keep him from declaring for president?
I think it does. It's something, that Fred Thompson faced in 2008 because he had a radio show, and if he becomes a declared candidate, then those radio stations are required to give equal access to his competitors. And so, NBC, which I believe does the Celebrity Apprentice, is not going to want to make a full hour available to any candidate who is running against Donald Trump. So, yes, I do think that the federal communications laws are a barrier for him if this is something that he's interested in, which is why he's, more or less just kind of feeling it out and hasn't declared anything yet. But, this is not a new issue. Back when former Governor Reagan ran for president, there were a number of television stations that were running old reruns of his movies. And some of them had to make the decision, once he declared for his candidacy for the presidency, they had to basically pull those movies because under the FCC rules, they didn't want to fend off the legal challenges from his competitors to say, give me equal access to your airwaves. And so, you have these candidates who are, on the airwaves in one fashion or another. And whether or not they're going to pull the trigger, the FCC rules do come into play there.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap things up there, Bill. I know we're going to have you back lots more as we get into the thick of election season, since it's a presidential campaign. As always, folks can hit Bill up for advice. His email address is wmcginley@pattenbogs.com. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about the issue of philanthropy and micro-giving.
market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back. We're going to talk about one of the new items on the radar screen this week. We're with Charlie Pinto, who works for technology startup in Silicon Valley and is a former captain of the University of Maryland wrestling program. He is one of the co-founders of an organization called Unite Change in the world of microphilanthropy. So, Charlie, welcome to Capital Thinking, and tell us a little bit about what you and your friends, what caused you and your friends to start Unite Change, and what makes you a little bit different from other organizations.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having us. So, just a brief background: Unite Change. We're a registered 501c3 nonprofit. We're actually based out of New York City. We have a team of four co-founders, myself included. It's Mike Cohen, Chris Tatarovich, and Jeff Todd. We also have a team of volunteers. So basically how we kind of set ourselves apart from other MPOs, we kind of consider ourselves a new kind of philanthropy. So it has to do with our ability to provide a personal connection between our donors and the projects which we fundraise for. The reason why I came up with that is we saw too many times in the past we all donated and never really knew what became of our donation. You know, did it reach its ultimate endpoint? Who did we impact? Did our donation change the life of some person in some way? So we weren't interested in the fact that we wanted to see if our money was used wisely, but we wanted to just see the impact of our donations, you know, what it did to that specific cause, person, or project. We also kind of wanted to feel like those millionaire philanthropists, but almost on a micro-philanthropic level.
I see. Well, tell me a little bit, explain what microphilanthropy is and how your group operates under that model.
Sure. So that's kind of our model. So microphilanthropy is a way to, you pull together a bunch of different donors, and collectively you impact a cause or a certain project. So basically our mission is to provide a more tangible approach to charity using this microphilanthropy model. We want our donors to feel connected to every aspect of all of our charitable projects, from the moment we launch to when the project's funded to when the project is ultimately completed. And then we broadcast these updates to our charitable, to our donors on an ongoing basis through email updates, blogs, social media, and right from multimedia from one of our various ways of communicating with our donors. So this way the donors get to see the project from start and finish. They feel like they feel a, more like the millionaire philanthropist we talked about, but on a lower level where, you know, they can give $5, $10, $15. They don't have to give those millions to actually see the impact of their donation.
Very good. And tell me a little bit about some of the projects that you're currently working on.
Sure. So the project we have right now is actually a really, really awesome project. Basically how our model works, we have these five-step process. The first one is kind of identifying a project ally. So our first step was to kind of figure out who this project ally is going to be. We did a huge background check on them, and we came out with Flying Kites Global. And basically what they do is that they operate an orphanage in Kenya. But they're a Brooklyn, U.S.-based charitable organization. They operate this orphanage and school. The school's got an IB curriculum for all their orphans, and their story and their mission is actually quite incredible. So they take these incredible children who really have had, you know, a hard time, and they take them into their orphanage, and these children really have the potential to change the world. Flying Kites provides the shelter, the education, and the caring for these children. And our specific project is to help them building their education complex. So right now they have a school, they have a clinic, but they don't really have a library. And so as we all know, a library is really a fundamental building block to education. So without it, without books, education is kind of stifled. So our first project is to build a library for these children. And further, we're also impacting the local community by, you know, giving them access to this library as well. As background, right now they drive over 3 hours in order to get or see a book. So once this library is built, everyone in the community will have access to it. Our current progress on that is incredible. We've raised over $12,000, which kicked off phase one of the project. So as background on phase one, it's basically building the foundation for the library, digging the ditches and laying the foundation. We still have a long ways to go. We have still phase two, which is putting up the library itself, and phase three, which is the final completion. But we're kind of well on our way. We still have close to about $70,000 in order to complete it, but we're definitely well on our way there.
Well, so tell me a little bit about how a project gets on your list. Can I recommend it to you? Did the founders out each looking for things related to their own interests? And how do you evaluate those projects as a board to figure out which ones to allow folks to donate to?
Sure. So me and the four co-founders who make up the board, we're always looking for new project allies. If someone's interested in partnering with us, more than happy to speak with them. So they typically just email us, contact@unitechange.org. And once you receive a request and it kind of meets our what we're looking for as far as it's a tangible project, people can see it, it's going to impact the local community. We're going to have very little say in what they want because we don't want to tell the community what they need. We want to hear from them and their nonprofit organization that represents them how what they need from us and what kind of funding they need. So what we do is we do a pretty complex background check on them. We go through a pretty complex evaluation process. We request more information on the organization, like their mission. We request information on their community, their background of the organization, some financial statements, and we ultimately want to speak to the management team as well. After we have that, we like to meet with them in person. We possibly visit the community they support. So in instance of Flying Kites, we've met with the management team numerous times. They're actually really great people. We've developed a really great relationship with them, and we also sent somebody out to visit their orphanage in Kenya, and it was fantastic. We came back with photos. We came back with a true sense of what they need.
Interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about where we can find information on Unite Change and how you can get involved as a volunteer, or most importantly, how you can get involved as a contributor.
Sure, absolutely. So you can go to Unite Change right now. It's unitechange.org. You can check out more information about our projects, about our organization itself. We actually operate two blogs that are associated with Unite Change. One is buildalibrary.unitechange.org, and basically that gives the project updates of what's going on over in Kenya. And the other one is blog.unitechange.org, and that gives some information about what we're doing with our organization. If you want to donate, unitechange.org/donate. It's a very simple process. Like we said, we're not looking for millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Of course, we should always accept it, but it's all tax deductible to the folks under the law. Obviously, contact your tax advisor for it. But you can make micro donations. You can make anything. Anything would help build a library for these orphan children and their community in Kenya. And if you want to learn more, if you want to get involved as a volunteer, we're always looking for people. Right now, we're looking for social media people who want to, you know, take care of our Facebook and Twitter, profiles. We're also looking for people who are engineers to help us build it and design the website. So we're always looking for people, and they can contact us directly, the entire board, at contact@unitechange.org.
Very good. Well, I think you talked about social media. We talked about that earlier in the show, and I think microphilanthropy sort of goes along with that trend of everybody personalizing their communication pattern and looking for opportunities to give to things that really matter to them and where their dollars can be made most effective. And so I applaud what you and your colleagues have done at Unite Change and what you're trying to do for the future. I think we're going to wrap things up here. We're keeping a close eye in Washington on whether or not we're going to get a budget deal. But whether or not the government goes out of business tomorrow night, certainly Capital Thinking will remain in business. We've got another exciting show planned for you next week, and we may be very well picking over the remains of this budget fight here in Washington. Until then, have a great weekend, and we'll see you next Thursday for more Capital Thinking.
Joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.